Side 5, Inversions by Ian M. Banks. Continuing on page 164.
What does it matter exactly how Unur did it? Dr. Skelim said. He must have been here when it happened. He ran away after it had happened. Of course he did it.
Dr. Skelim looked disgustedly at Dr. Vosil.
The doors to the chamber were neither locked nor guarded, the doctor pointed out. Unur may have been on any sort of errand and come back to find his master killed. As for...
Dr. Skelim shook his head and held up one hand towards the doctor.
These womanly fancies and this unhealthy attraction to mutilation may represent a form of sickness in the mind on your part, madam, but they have little to do with the business of apprehending the culprit and getting the truth out of him.
The doctor is right, Polchik told the doctor. It is clear that you know your way around a corpse, madam, but you must accept that I know mine around an act of villainy. Running is invariably a sign of guilt, I have found.
Unur may simply have been frightened, the doctor said. He did not appear to be possessed of a great amount of wit. He may simply have panicked, not thinking that running away was the most suspicious thing he could have done.
Well, we shall shortly apprehend him, Polchik said with an air of finality. And Rallenge here will find out the truth.
When the doctor spoke, it was with a degree of venom I think all of us found surprising.
Will he indeed? She said.
Rallenge smiled broadly at the doctor. Polchik's scarred face took on a look of some grimness.
Yes, madam, he will, he told her.
He flapped one hand at the corpse still lying between us.
This has all been most diverting, I'm sure, but on the next occasion you wish to impress some of your betters with your macabre knowledge of human anatomy, I would ask you not to include those of us with better things to do, and certainly not me. Good day.
Polchik turned and left, ducking under the doorway and acknowledging the salute of a guard. The scribe who had been sick looked up hesitantly from his incomplete notes and appeared uncertain what to do next.
I agree, Dr. Skelim said with a note of relish in his voice as he brought his small face up towards the doctor's. You might have bewitched our good king for now, madam, but you do not deceive me. If you have any regard for your own safety, you will request leave to depart from us as quickly as possible and return to whatever decadent regime raised you. Good day.
The gray-faced scribe hesitated again, watching the doctor's impassive face as Skelim swept smartly out of the chamber, head held high. Then the scribe muttered something to the still-smiling Rallenge, closed his slate book with a snap, and followed the small doctor.
They don't like you, Duke Quetel's chief torturer said to the doctor. His smile broadened still further. I like you.
The doctor looked across the slab at him for a few moments, then held up her hands and said,
Elf, a wet towel, if you please.
I ran and fetched a pitcher of water from a bench, picked a towel from the doctor's bag and soaked it, then watched her as she washed her hands, not taking her gaze off the small, round man across the slab from her. I handed her a dry towel. She dried her hands.
Rallenge kept on smiling.
You might think you hate what I am, Lady Doctor, he said softly. His voice sounded distorted by his grisly collection of teeth. But I know how to give pleasure as well as pain.
The doctor handed me the towel and said, Let us go, Elf. She nodded at Rallenge, and then we walked towards the door.
And pain can be pleasure, too, Rallenge called after us.
I felt my scalp crawl, and the urge to be sick returned. The doctor did not react at all.
It's just a cold, sir.
Ha! Just a cold. I've known people die from colds.
Indeed, sir, but you should not. How is your ankle today? Let's take a look at it, shall we?
I believe it is getting better. Will you change the dressing?
Of course. Elf, would you?
I took the dressing and a few instruments from the doctor's bag and arranged them on a cloth on the king's huge bed. We were in the king's private chamber the day after Noliethi's murder. The king's apartments at Evenir are arranged within a splendid domed cupola set high at the rear of the palace upon what is the roof to the main part of the great building. The gold-leaf-covered dome is set back from the terraced edge of the roof and separated from it by a small formal garden. As the roof level is just above the height of the tallest trees on the ridge behind, marking the summit of the hills on this side of the valley, the view from the north-facing windows which bring light into the most spacious and airy apartments is of nothing but sky beyond the clipped geometrical perfections of the gardens and the white tusk balustrade at their edge. This lends the apartments a strange, enchanted air of detachment from the real world. I dare say the clear mountain air contributes to this effect of isolated purity, but there is something most especially about that lack of sight of the mundane disorder of the landscape of men which gives the place its singular spirit. "Will I be well enough for the ball at the next small moon?" the king asked the doctor as he watched her prepare the new dressing for his ankle. In truth, the old dressing looked spotless, as the king had taken to his bed with a tingly throat and sneezing fits shortly after the news of Noliates' demise had been communicated to us in the hidden gardens the day before. "I should imagine you will be able to attend, sir," the doctor said, "but do try not to sneeze over everybody." "I am the king, Vosil," the king told her, sniffing into a fresh handkerchief. "I shall sneeze over whom I please."
"Then you will spread the ill humor to others. They will incubate it while you grow well again. They will perhaps subsequently inadvertently sneeze in your presence and consequently reinfect you, who will play host to it again while they recover, and so on."
"Don't lecture me, doctor. I'm in no mood for it."
The king looked round at the slumped pile of pillows propping him up, opened his mouth to call a servant, but then started to sneeze, his blonde locks bouncing as his head went back and forth. The doctor stood up from her chair, and while he was still sneezing, pulled the king upright and rearranged his pillows. The king looked at her in some surprise.
"You are stronger than you look, are you not, doctor?"
"Yes, sir,"
the doctor said with a modest smile, as she went back to undoing the dressing on the king's ankle.
"And yet still weaker than I would be."
She was dressed as she had been the day before. Her long red hair was more carefully prepared than was usual, combed and plaited and hanging down her long dark jacket almost to her slim waist. She looked at me, and I became aware that I was staring. I looked down at my feet. Poking out from under the great bed's valance was a corner of cream-colored clothing that looked oddly familiar. I wondered at this for a moment or two, until, with a pang of jealousy for the right of kings, I realized it was part of a shepherdess's costume. I pushed it further under the valance with my shoe. The king settled himself back amongst his pillows.
"What is the news on that boy who ran away? The one who killed my chief questioner?"
"They caught him this morning," the doctor said, busying herself with the old dressing. "However, I do not think he committed the murder."
"Really?" the king said. "Personally, master, I do not think he sounded as if he particularly cared one way or the other what the doctor thought on this matter." But this was the cue for the doctor to explain in some detail, especially to a man, however exalted, who had a cold and had just eaten a light breakfast, exactly why she had convinced herself that Unur had not killed Nolieti. I have to say that the consensus amongst the other apprentices, assistants, and pages, arrived at in the kitchen parlor of the palace the previous evening, was that the only perplexing aspect about the whole business was how Unur had been able to put off the dark deed for so long. "Well," the king said, "I dare say Quetel's fellow will get the truth out of him."
"The truth, sir? Or what is required to satisfy the prejudices of those already convinced they know the truth?"
"What?"
the king said, dabbing at his reddened nose.
"This barbaric custom of torture, sir. It produces not the truth, but rather whatever those commanding the questioner wish to hear, for the agonies involved are so unbearable that those subject to them will confess to anything, or more precisely, will confess to what they think their tormentors wish them to confess to, in the hope of causing the suffering to cease."
The king looked at the doctor with an expression of confusion and disbelief.
"People are beasts, Vosil. Lying beasts. The only way to get the truth out of them sometimes is to wring it from them."
The king snorted mightily.
"My father taught me that."
The doctor looked at the king for a long moment, then started to undo the old dressing.
"Indeed. Well, I'm sure he could not possibly have been wrong, sir," she said.
She supported the king's foot with one hand and unwound the white dressing with the other. She started sniffing, too. The king kept on sniffing and snorting and staring at the doctor. "Dr. Vosil," he asked eventually, as the last of the dressing floated free from his ankle, and the doctor gave it to me to put away. "Sir?" she asked, wiping her eyes on her cuff and looking away from Quience.
"Madam, have I upset you?"
"No," the doctor said quickly. "No, sir." She made as though to start applying the new dressing, then put it aside and made an exasperated clicking noise with her mouth. She busied herself with the inspection of the small wound healing on the king's ankle, and then ordered me to fetch water and soap, which I had already provided and set by the bed. She seemed annoyed that I had done this, but quickly ensured the wound was clean, washed and dried the king's foot, and began to secure the new dressing. The king appeared discomfited during all this. When the doctor was finished, he looked at her and said, "You will be looking forward to the ball yourself, doctor." She smiled briefly at him.
"Of course, Your Majesty."
We packed our things away. As we were about to take our leave, the king reached out and took the doctor's hand. There was a troubled, uncertain look I did not think I had seen before in his eyes. He said, "Women bear pain better than men, they say, doctor." His eyes seemed to search hers. "It is ourselves we hurt most when we question." The doctor looked down at her hand, held within the king's.
"Women bear pain better because we must give birth, sir," she said in a low voice. "Such pain is generally regarded as being unavoidable, but is alleviated to whatever extent it can be by those of my calling." She looked up into his eyes. "And we only become beasts. We become worse than beasts when we torment others, sir."
She took her hand carefully from his, picked up her bag, and with a small bow to the king, turned and headed for the doors. I hesitated, half expecting the king to call her back, but he did not. He just sat there in his vast bed, looking hurt and sniffing. I bowed to the king and followed the doctor. Unur was never put to the question. A few hours after he was captured and brought back to the palace, while the doctor and I were attending the king, and while Rallange was still preparing the chamber for his inquisition, a guard looked in on the cell where the youth was being held. Somehow, Unur had slit his own throat with a small knife. His arms and legs were tightly chained behind him, and he had been stripped naked before being placed in the cell. The knife had been wedged hilt first into a crack in the stone walls of the cell at about waist height. Unur had been able to kneel before it at the extremity of the reach the chains securing him would allow, and slice his neck across its blade before collapsing and bleeding to death. I understand that the two guard commanders were furious. The guards who had been charged with Unur's custody were lucky they were neither punished nor put to the question themselves. It was eventually agreed that Unur must have placed the knife there before his attack on Nolieti, in case he was captured and brought back to the palace. Our shared station might dictate both that we knew little and that our opinions were worth less, but none of us who had had occasion to experience the full extent of Unur's intelligence, forethought, and cunning found this explanation even remotely convincing. Quetel.
"Good Duke, how very pleasant it is to see you. Is this not a fine view?"
Waylon.
"I find you well, Quetel."
Q.
"In most rude health. You?"
W.
"Tolerable."
Q.
"I thought you might want to sit down. See, I have arranged for chairs."
W.
"Thank you, no. Let us go over here."
Q.
"Oh, well, very well. Well, here we are, and afforded an even finer view. However, I cannot imagine you wished to meet me up here to admire my own estates."
W.
"Q. "Allow me to hazard a guess. You have some misgivings about, what was his name, Nolieti? Nolieti's death? Or rather, about his and his apprentices?"
W.
"No, I believe that matter is closed. I attach no great significance to the death of a pair of torturers. Theirs is a despicable, if necessary, craft."
Q.
"Despicable?
Oh, no, no indeed. Why, I would call it a form of art at its most elevated. My man, Rallinge, is a veritable master. I have only avoided singing his praises to Quience because I'm afraid he might take him from me, and that would be most upsetting. I should feel deprived.
W.
No, my concern is with one whose profession is concerned with the alleviation of pain, not the causing of it.
Q.
Really? Ah, you mean that woman who calls herself a doctor? Yes. What does the king see in her? Can't he just fuck her and have done with it?
W.
Perhaps he has. More likely he has not. She looks at him in a way that leads me to believe she would like to be tumbled, but I care not either way. The point is that he seems convinced of her efficacy as a physician.
Q.
And what? There is someone you would rather see in her place?
W.
Yes, anybody. I believe she is a spy, or a witch, or something between the two.
Q.
I see. Have you told the king?
W.
Of course not.
Q.
Aha. Well, my own physician is of much the same opinion as yourself, if that is any comfort, which I warn you it ought not to be, really, given that my physician is a self-important fool and no better than any of the rest of these blood letters and sawbones at curing anything.
W.
Yes, quite. I am sure, nevertheless, that your physician is as competent a doctor as can be found, and so I am glad that he shares my opinion of the woman Vosil. That may well prove useful if eventually we have to convince the king of her unsuitability. I can tell you that Guard Commander Adlane feels that she is a threat too, though he agrees with me that it is not yet possible to move against her. That is why I wanted to talk to you. May I rely on your discretion? I wish to speak of something that would have to be done without the king's knowledge, even though it would be done solely to protect him.
Hugh.
Hmm? Yes, of course, good Duke. Go on. Nothing will go beyond these walls. Well, balustrades.
W.
I have your word.
Q.
Of course, of course.
W.
Adlane and I had an agreement with Nulieti that, should it prove necessary, the woman could be taken and put to the question without reference to the king.
Q.
Ah, I see.
W.
This plan was ready to be put into effect while we traveled from Haspid to here. But now we are here, and Nulieti is dead. I would ask you to be willing and ready to put a similar plan into effect. If your fellow Rallinge is as efficient as you say, then he ought to have no difficulty extracting the truth from the woman.
Q.
Certainly. To date, I can think of no woman who has been able to resist his advances in that respect.
W.
Well, then, will you let some part of the palace guard arrange for her apprehension, or at least allow it to take place without their interference?
Q.
I see. And what would be my interest in doing so?
W.
Your interest? Why, the safety of the king, sir.
Q.
Which is, of course, my first concern, as it is so clearly and creditably yours, dear Duke. Yet without some obviously deleterious action by the woman, it might rather look as though one was acting on no more than your own dislike of her, however well informed.
W.
My likes and dislikes are predicated entirely on what is good for the royal house, and I would hope that my service over the past many years, indeed decades, has proved that. You care less than nothing for the woman. Are you saying you would object?
Q.
You have to see this from my standpoint, dear Waylon. While you are all here, the responsibility for your safety is formally mine. On this occasion, only a few days after the arrival of the court at Evenir, one of its officers was killed unlawfully, and his murderer escaped the questioning and punishment that should rightfully have been his. That displeased me greatly, sir, and it was only because the matter was concluded almost as soon as it began, and appeared to be entirely internal to the royal court, that I felt no more insulted. Even so, I think Polchik does not realize how close he came to being brought down a rung or two. And I might add that my guard commander still worries that something is being hidden, that the apprentice's death was somehow arranged by somebody who might have benefited from his silence. But in any event, if after such a murder and suicide a favorite of the king were to disappear,
then it would mean that I would have no choice but to discipline Polchik with the utmost severity. My honor could be preserved by nothing less, and arguably would still suffer. I would need the most decidedly persuasive proof that the woman meant the king some harm before I could possibly countenance any such action.
W.
I fancy the only proof you would accept would be the king's corpse, and that alone might prove satisfactory to you.
Q. Duke Whalen, I would hope that your wit might devise a way to discover the woman's fraudulent nature long before that could possibly occur.
W.
Indeed. And I have just such a commission in hand.
Q. There, you see. And what is your plan?
W.
Close to fruition, I hope.
Q. You will not tell me?
W.
It is unfortunate that it seems neither of us can indulge the other, Quetel.
Q.
Yes, isn't it?
W.
I have no more to say, I think.
Q.
Very well.
Oh, Duke.
W.
Sir?
Q.
I take it I can rely on the woman not still somehow disappearing while the court rests at even ear, can I? If she did, I might have to think most carefully about whether to reveal to the king what you have revealed to me.
W.
You gave me your word.
Q.
Why, that I did, dear Whalen. But I'm sure you would agree that my first loyalty is to the king, not to you. If I judged that the king was being deceived for no persuasive reason, it would be my duty to inform him.
W.
I am sorry I have troubled you, sir. It would appear that we have both wasted our time this morning.
Q.
Good day, Whalen.
This, too, I found later, not in the doctor's journal, but in some other papers, and have edited it slightly to present a more continuous narrative. The common participant of these two passages is Whalen, but especially given all that happened later, I simply do not know what to make of it. I record. I do not judge. I do not even offer speculation.
12. The Bodyguard.
The Royal Park of Croghan Hills had been a private game reserve of the Royal House of Tassassin for several centuries. Erlane had parceled large parts of it out to various of the nobles who had supported his cause in the War of Succession, but reserved the right of the Protector and his court to go hunting in the forests. The four mounts and their riders circled the tall clump of brush and tangled creeper bush where they reckoned their prey had gone to ground. Rulluin took out his sword and leaned down from the saddle, poking at the mass of vegetation.
"Are you sure he went in here, brother?"
"Quite certain," Erlane said, dipping his face towards his mount's neck and squinting at an opening into the bushes. He lowered himself still further, letting go of the reins with one hand to peer into the undergrowth. Diwa, riding at his side, reached out to hold the reins of Erlane's mount. Rulluin, on the far side of the bushes, also leant down upon the neck of his mount.
"How is the boy today, Erlane?" Yetamidas said, voice booming. His big face was red and bright with sweat.
"Oh, he's well," Erlane said, levering himself upright again. "Better with every day. Still not strong, though."
He glanced round, looking back up the slope beneath the trees.
"We need some beaters here."
"Get your dark man to beat for us," Yetamidas said to Erlane, referring to Diwar.
"You'll get down and beat for us, won't you, Diwar?"
Diwar smiled thinly.
"I only beat out human prey, General Yetamidas."
"Human prey, eh?" Yetamidas said with a hearty laugh.
"Those were the days, what?"
He slapped his saddle. Diwar's thin smile lasted a little longer.
In the last years of the Old Kingdom, when King Bedon had been at his most carelessly cruel, prisoners, or poachers unlucky enough to be caught plying their trade in the forest, had provided most of the prey for hunts. That tradition of savagery had been outlawed, but there was one memento of the time present, Diwar thought, in the shape of the old King Bedon's antique hunting crossbow, which Erlane carried slung over his back. Erlane, Diwar, Yetamidas, and Rulluin had become separated from the main part of the hunt, which could be heard on the far side of the hill.
"Sound your horn, will you, Yet?" Erlane said.
Let's get some of the others here.
Right you are.
Yet Amadeus brought his horn to his lips and let a great blare of sound escape. It almost coincided, Diwar noticed, with the sound of horns coming from the other side of the hill, so probably was not heard. He chose not to say anything. Yet Amadeus shook some spit from the horn's mouthpiece and looked pleased with himself.
"Is Valbota joining us, Protector?" he asked. "I thought he was supposed to."
"A message came this morning," Erlaine said, standing up in the saddle to stare into the clump of bushes. He shielded his eyes as a beam of sunlight fell across his face. "He has been detained at..." He looked at Diwar.
"I believe it is the city of Vinda, sir."
"Vinda. The city of Vinda is proving more resilient than expected." Ruluin stood in the saddle, too, and directed his gaze at the same place as his brother. "There was talk that we lost a couple of the siege mortars," he said.
"It is only a rumor as yet," Erlaine said. "Simalg has rushed ahead, as usual, and outdistanced his supporting forces. Communication has been erratic. With Simalg, you never know. He may have advanced too fast for his guns, or otherwise misplaced them. Let's not assume the worst."
"I have heard other grumbles still, Protector," yet Amadeus said, undoing the top of a wineskin and taking a quick gulp. "Perhaps we should go to Ladenshin ourselves and take matters in hand."
Yet Amadeus' brows compressed.
"I tell you, Protector, I miss making war, and I'd warrant you, for one, would not misplace siege guns."
"Yes," Ruluin said. "You ought to take charge of the war yourself, brother."
"I have thought about it," Erlaine said. He unsheathed his own sword and whacked at the tops of some bushes. "I have been concerned to appear less of a warlord and more of a statesman, and anyway did not reckon the rebellion in Ladenshin merited the full weight of our forces. But I may change my mind if I think the situation demands it. I shall wait for Relbuta's return, or for a message from him. Yet, blow that horn again, would you? I don't think they heard the first time."
Erlaine put away his sword and took off his green hunting cap. He wiped his brow.
"Ha!" Yet Amadeus said.
He lifted the hunting horn, took a gargantuan breath that raised his formidable body off the saddle of his mount, and turned his expression into a deep frown, then put the instrument to his lips and blew with all his might, his face going scarlet with the effort. The note was fit to split ears. Almost immediately there was a rustle and a commotion on the downslope side of the clump of bushes. Diwar was closest. He caught a glimpse of a big, thick-set, gray-brown shape dart away at a furious pace towards another conglomeration of vegetation.
"Ha!" Yet Amadeus bellowed. "Flush the fucker!"
"Diwar!" Erlaine shouted. "Did you see him?"
"There, sir."
"Rue! Yet! This way!"
Erlaine wheeled his mount and charged off in the same direction. Diwar preferred to ride right at Erlaine's side whenever he could, but in the dense thickets of the park woods it was often impossible, and he would have to follow the Protector's mount through the undergrowth, over fallen tree trunks and under hanging boughs as best he could, ducking and leaning, and sometimes hanging half out of the saddle to avoid the snagging branches. Taking the direction that Diwar had indicated, Erlaine set off at a gallop down a shallow slope, his mount thundering along the hint of path amongst the crowding bushes. Diwar followed, trying to keep in view the bobbing green shape that was Erlaine's cap. The incline was covered by undergrowth and overhung by the crisscrossed trunks of trees which had started to fall but been caught by their healthier fellows. A confusion of lushly green limbs and twisted branches made the going difficult. The footing for the mounts was treacherous. The deep litter of rotting leaves, twigs, fruits, and seed cases could hide a multitude of holes, burrow entrances, rocks, and partially decayed logs, any one of which could break a mount's leg or trip it and bring it tumbling to the ground. Erlaine was going too fast. Diwar was never so fearful for his own life or for his master's than when he tried to keep up with him on some mad dash during a hunt. He did his best, all the same, attempting to steer his mount down the trail of broken branches and trampled litter that Erlaine had taken. Behind him, he could hear the mounts of Yet Amadeus and Ruluin also crashing in pursuit. The animal they were hunting was an ort, a powerful, thick-set scavenger a third the size of a mount.
They were usually regarded as belligerent and stupid, but Diwar thought the reputation undeserved. Orts ran until they were cornered, and only then did they fight, using their small, sharp horns and their even sharper teeth. And they tried to avoid the clear areas under the high canopies where galloping was easy, and the ground relatively free of brush and other obstructions. Instead, they made for places like this, where a jumble of living and dead trees and their associated debris made both observation and chase difficult. The trail led down a steepening slope towards a stream. Erlane whooped and shouted and disappeared further ahead. Diwar cursed and urged his mount to go faster. It shook its head and snorted, refusing. Diwar tried to stop himself watching where his mount was putting its feet, best to leave that to the animal. He would be better occupied ducking to avoid the overhanging boughs and branches that threatened to knock him senseless or gouge out his eyes. From far away he heard the sound of the rest of the hunt, men shouting, horns blaring, hounds yapping, prey screaming. From the noise, the others must have cornered a large group. The single beast Erlane was chasing had succeeded in escaping without any hounds in pursuit. It was a big animal, and hunting it without hounds was a brave or foolish thing to do. Diwar took one hand briefly off the reins and wiped his face with one sleeve. The day was hot, and the air under the great trees still and sticky. Sweat still trickled down his face, stinging in his eyes and producing a salty taste in his mouth. Behind him, a sharp report was the noise of a gun going off, probably an ort being dispatched, or a musketeer losing half his face. Guns small enough to be carried by a man, or even on the back of a mount, were unreliable, inaccurate, and often more dangerous for the firer than the fired at. Gentlemen did not use them, and crossbows were superior in most respects. Still, the smiths and armorers labored to produce better examples of muskets with each passing season, and Erlane had used the weapons to good effect against cavalry charges during the War of Succession. Diwar worried that one day within his lifetime guns would be reliable enough, and more importantly sufficiently accurate, to provide a bodyguard with his worst nightmares. But for now, that day still seemed a fair way off. A scream came from somewhere off to the left, down the small valley of the stream. It might have been human or ort. It sent a shiver through Diwar, despite the heat. He had lost sight of Erlane. Branches and leaves swayed and thrashed ahead to his left. With a cold feeling in his guts, Diwar wondered if the scream he had heard had been from the Protector. He swallowed hard, wiping his face again and attempting to wave away insects buzzing angrily round his head. A branch caught him on the face, stinging his right cheek. What if Erlane had fallen from his mount? He might have been gored or had his throat bitten out. Last year, near here, one of the younger nobles had somersaulted off his falling mount and been impaled through the back and belly on a jagged remnant of tree trunk. His screams had sounded like that scream, hadn't they? He tried to urge his mount to go faster. A branch snagged on the crossbow slung over his back, almost yanking him out of his saddle. Diwar hauled on the reins, and the animal below him shrieked as the metal bit cut into its mouth. He twisted in the saddle and tried unsuccessfully to untangle himself. Upslope, he could see Ruluin and Yetamidus approaching. He swore, pulled his dagger, and hacked at the offending branch. It parted from the tree, remaining lodged in the crossbow, but letting him go. He kicked his spurs into the mount's side, and it started off down the slope again. He burst out of the undergrowth, down a suddenly steep earth bank, and into a clearing by the stream side. Erlane's mount stood riderless by a tree, panting. Diwar looked wildly around for the Protector, then saw him standing a little way off, near where the stream appeared from a jumble of fallen rocks, his crossbow at his shoulder, aiming at the big ort, which was whining and squealing as it tried to jump up the slippy, moss-covered rocks, barring its way up and out of the clearing. The ort leapt halfway up the boulder slope, seemed to be about to find further perches on the rocks and complete its escape. Then, with a grunt, it lost its footing and fell, bouncing off a lower rock and landing heavily on its back by the side of the stream. It struggled to its feet, shaking itself.
Erlane advanced a couple of steps closer to the animal, crossbow aimed. Diwar unslung his own bow as he dismounted. He wanted to shout to Erlane, to tell him to get back on his mount and leave the animal to him, but he was afraid of distracting the other man while the Ort was so close. The Ort turned its attention away from the rocks. It growled at Erlane, who was now 5 or 6 strides away. Its only way out now was past the man. Now, thought Diwar, shoot! Loose! Fire! Now! He was another 10 or so strides behind Erlane. He took a few slow steps to the right, along the bottom edge of the earth bank, widening the angle he could see between Erlane and the Ort. He tried to ready his own crossbow for firing without looking at it, frightened to take his eyes off the protector and the prey he had cornered. Something was stuck in the crossbow. He could feel it. The branch it had snagged on earlier. His hand closed around leaves and twigs, trying to pull them free, failing. Snarling, the Ort backed away from the slowly advancing Erlane. The animal's rump bumped into one of the mossy boulders it had tried to scale. It angled its head downwards fractionally. Its slightly curved horns were only just longer than a man's hand, but each came to a point sharp enough to disembowel a mount. Erlane was wearing a light hide jerkin and trousers. Diwar had suggested heavier clothing or some chain mail in addition that morning, before they had set off, but the protector was having none of it. The day was going to be too hot as it was. The Ort lowered its rear quarters. With a clarity which seemed almost unnatural, Diwar could see the muscles in the Ort's quarters bunching, tensing. He pulled at the foliage stuck in his crossbow, waggling it. The dagger. He might have to forget about the crossbow and try throwing the dagger. It did not throw well, but it was the only other choice he had. The branch started to tear free from the crossbow. Brother! A voice boomed out above him. Diwar whirled to see Ruluin high above him, his mount's front hooves near the edge of the earth bank. Erlane's brother, his face caught in a stray beam of sunlight, was shading his eyes with one hand and looking across the clearing at the far bank. Then his gaze dropped to the clearing and Erlane. "Oh," he said quietly. Diwar looked quickly back. The Ort had not moved. It was still growling softly, still tensed. Saliva dripped from one edge of its mouth. Diwar heard his mount give a single small whimper. Erlane made a tiny movement. There was a barely heard click. Then the man seemed to freeze. Shit, he said softly. Crossbows could kill from hundreds of strides away. A quarrel from one could pierce a metal breastplate at close range. There was rarely time to stop, tension, and load a bow during the heat of a hunt. One rode with the bow wound up and ready to fire, and many kept it loaded, too. Crossbows hanging from saddles had shot more than one hunter in the foot, or worse, and those over a man's back could be even more deadly if they snagged on a branch in a thicket. And so a hunting crossbow had a safety latch. One had to remember to undo it before the weapon would fire. In the excitement of the chase, it was not unusual for a hunter to forget to do so. And Erlane's crossbow, which had been King Bedon's, was an old one. The latch release had been added later, not designed in, and was positioned badly towards the rear of the weapon and not so easy to slip. Erlane would have to move one hand from its position to make the adjustment. The king Erlane had executed might have his revenge from beyond the grave. Diwar held his breath. The branch which had tangled in his own bow fell to the ground. Still not taking his eyes off the Ort, Diwar watched Erlane slowly move one hand to the safety latch on his crossbow. The weapon, its weight supported by one hand, shook. The Ort growled louder and shifted its position slightly, sidestepping closer to the stream, narrowing Diwar's angle of fire so much that one side of its head was now hidden by Erlane's body. Above him, Diwar could hear Ruluin's mount breathing. Diwar felt for his bow's safety latch as he brought it up to his shoulder and took another step to the right to open the angle again. "What? What's this? Where?" another voice said from above, to the accompaniment of swishing leaves and stamping hooves. "Yet Amadis." Erlane gently unclipped the safety on the crossbow and started to move his hand back towards the trigger again. The Ort charged.
Erlane's crossbow started to drop, hinging down as the protector tried to track the animal racing towards him. He began to leap at the same time, moving to the right, obscuring the clear shot Diwar had had of the Ort. Diwar released the trigger on the bow just in time, an instant before the bolt would have flown towards the protector. Suddenly, Erlane's hunting cap leaped from his head and went tumbling away towards the stream. Diwar registered this without thinking what had caused it. He started to run towards Erlane, leaning forward, pushing off with one foot, then the other, holding the bow in front of his belly, pointing to one side. Erlane was slipping, the foot he had put his weight on beginning to flick out from underneath him. Two steps, three. Something whirred past Diwar's head and left a curl of wind to stroke his cheek. An instant later, there was a splash in the stream, the water kicking high into the air. Four steps. Still picking up speed, each stride more like a leap. The protector's crossbow made a cracking, twanging noise. The bow pushed back in Erlane's hands. The bolt appeared in the left haunch of the charging Ort, making the animal scream, leap into the air, and twist its hips. But when it landed again, two strides from the stumbling, falling Erlane, it lowered its horned head and charged straight at him. Five, six steps. Erlane hit the ground. The Ort's snout thudded into his left hip. It reared back and darted forward again, head lower this time, aiming for the fallen man's midriff as he started to raise one hand in an attempt to fend the animal off. Seven. Diwa brought the crossbow round as he ran, still at waist height. He took a half stride to steady it as best he could, then pulled the trigger. The quarrel hit the Ort just above the left eye. The animal quivered and stopped in its tracks. The feathered bolt protruded from its skull like a third horn. Diwar was four, then three steps away, throwing the crossbow aside as his left hand crossed to his right hip and the handle of the long dagger. Erlane kicked, pivoting his lower body away from the Ort, which was looking down at the ground less than a pace away from him, snorting and shaking its head while its front legs buckled and it settled to the ground. Diwar drew the dagger and leapt over Erlane as the older man rolled away from the Ort, landing between the two. The Ort snorted and puffed and shook its head and looked up with what Diwar would always swear was a surprised expression as he plunged the dagger into its neck near its left ear and in one swift movement opened its throat to the air. The animal made a whooshing noise and collapsed to the ground, head tucked into its chest, its dark blood spreading around it. Diwar kept the dagger pointing towards it as he knelt there, feeling behind him with his free hand to make sure where Erlane was. "Are you all right, sir?" he asked without looking round. The Ort jerked, seemed to be trying to get to its feet, then rolled over on its side, legs trembling. The blood continued to gush from its neck. Then the animal stopped shaking. The blood began to seep rather than pulse, and slowly the beast's legs folded into its body as finally it died. Erlane pulled himself up onto his knees by Diwar. He put one hand on the other man's shoulder. The protector's grip felt shaky. "I am chastened, I think would be the right word, Diwar. Thank you." "Providence. Big bugger, isn't he?" "Big enough, sir," Diwar said, deciding the motionless animal was little enough of a threat to let him risk glancing behind to where Yetamardus and Reluin were making their way down a shallow sloped part of the earth bank. Their mounts stood on the bank, looking down at Erlane and his own mount. The two men approached at a run. Yetamardus still held his discharged crossbow. Diwar looked back at the Ort, then stood, sheathed the long dagger, and helped Erlane to his feet. The protector's arm trembled, and he did not let go of Diwar's arm once he had stood up. "Oh, sir," Yetamardus cried, clutching his crossbow to his chest. His broad, round face looked gray. "Are you unharmed? I thought I'd... Reluin came dashing up, nearly tripping on Diwar's crossbow where it lay on the ground. "Brother!" He threw his arms wide and almost knocked his brother over as he hugged him, pulling Erlane's hand away from Diwar. On the slope above, the sounds of the main part of the hunt were coming closer. Diwar glanced back at the Ort. It looked very dead.
"And who fired first?" Perrin asked quietly and without moving. Her head was tipped, lowered over the secret keep board, studying her next move. They were sitting in the visiting chamber of the harem, towards ninth bell. There had been a particularly noisy after-hunt feast that evening, though Erlane had retired early. "It was yet Amadis," Diwar said, no more loudly. His was the shot that lifted the Protector's cap off his head. The cap was found downstream. The bolt was embedded inside a log by the stream, a finger breadth lower.
"Indeed. And so it was Reluins that just missed you."
"And just missed Erlane, too, though I think it was his waist it missed by a hand's breadth or so, not his head by a finger's."
"Could each bolt plausibly have been meant for the Ort?"
"Yes. Neither man is regarded as a marksman. If yet Amadis really was aiming for Erlane's head, then I imagine that most of the people in the court who consider themselves authorities on this sort of matter would judge it as a surprisingly accurate shot, given the circumstances. And yet Amadis did seem genuinely shocked that he'd missed the Protector by so small a margin. And Reluin is his brother, for all providence." Diwar sighed heavily, then yawned and rubbed his eyes. "And yet Amadis, as well as being a poor shot, is just not the type to be an assassin."
"Hmm," Perrin said in a particular tone.
"What?" Only as he said this did Diwar realize how well he felt he had come to know the woman. Just the way she had made that single sound had meant much to him.
"I have a friend who spends quite a lot of time in Yet Amadis' company," Perrin said softly. "She has said that he delights in card games played for money. He takes even greater delight in making it seem that he is ignorant of the subtleties of the games, and pretending that he is a poor player. He appears to forget the rules, has to ask what to do at certain points, inquires as to the meaning of terms the other players use, and so on. Often he will deliberately lose a series of small bets. In fact, he is only waiting until an especially large wager is at stake, whereupon he almost invariably wins, much to his own apparent surprise. She has seen this happen time after time. His friends are wise to him now, and are amused as well as wary. But many a young and smirking nobleman who thought himself in the presence of a bumbling fool ripe for the picking has been lucky to leave Yet Amadis' house with a coin to call his own." Diwar realized that he was biting his lip as he stared at the game board. "So the man is a skilled dissembler, not a buffoon. That is worrying." He looked up at Perrin, though she did not meet his gaze. He found himself inspecting the blonde mass of her gathered-up hair, marveling at its sheen and perfect fairness. "Your friend would not have any further observations or opinions on the gentleman, would she?" Still not looking up, Perrin took a long, deep breath. He watched her shoulders in the red gown, glanced down to the swell of material over her breasts. "Once, perhaps twice," she said, "when Yet Amadis has been very drunk, she has thought he revealed a certain jealous contempt for the Protector. And I think he has little regard for you." She looked up suddenly.
Diwar felt himself rock back slightly, as though afflicted by the force of the gaze from those blue-flecked gold eyes.
"Though none of this is to say that he is not still a good and loyal follower of the Protector," Perrin said. "If one is determined to find fault, then looking hard enough will produce reason to distrust everybody." She looked down again.
"Of course," Diwar said, and felt his face grow warm. "Still, I would rather know such things than not." Perrin moved one piece, then another.
"There," she said.
Diwar continued with his analysis of the game. 13. The Doctor. Master, the masked ball took place 6 days later. The king still had a slight cold, but the doctor had given him a preparation made from flowers and mountain herbs, which dried up his membranes, by which I think she meant his nose, for the duration of the dance. She advised him to avoid alcohol and to drink copious amounts of water, or better still, fruit juice. However, I believe that during the ball he was quickly persuaded, principally by himself, that the definition of fruit juice might include wine, and so drank a deal of that during the ball. The grand ballroom of Evenage is a dramatic, circular space, half of whose circumference is taken up with floor-to-ceiling windows.
In the year since the court had last visited Evenir, the windows had been refashioned throughout their lower quarter. The great pastel green plaster panels had been replaced with a grid of wood holding smaller panes of thin, colorless glass. The glass was almost crystal in its perfection, affording a barely distorted view of the moonlit landscape of forested hills across the valley. The effect was extraordinarily eye-catching, and it seemed from the expressions of wonder I heard uttered, and the extravagance of the estimates made within my earshot concerning the cost of such a project, that people could hardly have been more impressed had the new windows been made of diamond. The orchestra sat on a low circular stage set in the center of the room, each player facing inwards to watch their conductor, who swiveled towards each section of the musicians in turn. The dancers swirled round this focus like fallen leaves caught within a spiraling wind, the intricate sets and patterns of the dances providing an order within that apparent chaos. The doctor was one of the more striking women present. Partly the effect was achieved through her height. There were taller women there, yet still she seemed to shine out amongst them. She possessed a bearing that was in all senses naturally elevated. She wore a gown that was plain by comparison with most. It was a dark and lustrous green to set off the wide, netted fan of her carefully arrayed red hair. Her gown was unfashionably narrow. Master, I confess I felt excited and honored to be there. The doctor having no other escort, it fell to me to accompany her to the ball, and so I was able to think with some pleasure of my fellow apprentices and assistants, most of whom were banished downstairs. Only the senior pages were permitted to attend, and the few of those not expected to act purely as servants were all too aware of their inability to shine in a company containing so many junior noblemen. The doctor, in contrast, treated me as her equal, and made not one demand on me as an apprentice the whole ball long. The mask I had chosen was a plain one of flesh-colored paper painted so that one half looked happy with a big smile at the lips and a raised brow, while the other side looked sad with downcast mouth and a small tear at the eye. The doctor's was a half-face made of light, highly polished silver treated with some sort of lacquer. It was, I thought, the best and perhaps the most disconcerting mask that I saw all that night, for it reflected the observer's gaze right back at them, and so disguised the wearer, for whatever that was worth, given the doctor's unmistakable form, better than the most cunning creation of feathers, filigreed gold, or sparkling gems. Beneath the mirror-like mask, the doctor's lips looked full and tender. She had colored them with the red oil cream that many of the ladies at court use for such occasions. I had never seen her adorn herself so before. How moist and succulent that mouth looked. We sat at a great table in one of the ballroom's anterooms, surrounded by fine ladies of the court and their escorts, and looked down upon by huge paintings of nobles, their animals, and estates. Servants with drinks trays circulated everywhere. I couldn't recall having seen a ball so well staffed before, though it did seem to me that some of the servants looked a bit rough and ready, handling their trays with a degree of awkwardness. The doctor did not choose to stay in the ballroom itself between dances, and seemed reluctant to take part at all. I formed the impression she was only there because the king expected her to be, and while she might have enjoyed the dances, she was afraid of making some error of etiquette. I myself also felt nervous as well as excited. Such grand balls are opportunities for much pomp and ceremony, attracting from all around scores of great families, dukes and duchesses, rulers of allied principalities and their entourages, and generally producing a kind of concentration of people of power and circumstance one sees seldom enough even in the capital. Little wonder that these are occasions when allegiances, plans, alliances, and enmities are formed, both on the political and national scale of things, and at the personal level. It was impossible not to feel affected by the urgency and momentousness of the atmosphere, and my poor emotions felt tattered and frazzled before the ball was properly begun. At least we ought to remain safely on the periphery. With so many princes, dukes, barons, ambassadors, and the like demanding his time,
many of whom he would not see from one year to the next, save for this single event, the king was unlikely to concern himself with the doctor and myself, who were at his beck and call during every day of the year. I sat there, immersed in the hum of conversation, and listening to the distant sound of a dance tune, and I wondered what plots and schemes were being hatched, what promises and enemies were being made, what desires stoked, what hopes squashed. A group of people were passing us, heading for the ballroom. The small figure of a man at their head turned towards us. His mask was an old one, made of blue-black feathers. "Ah, the lady doctor, unless I am grievously mistaken," came the harsh, cracked voice of Duke Whalen. He stopped. His wife, his second, much younger than he, and small and voluptuous, hung on his arm, her golden mask dripping with gems. Various junior members of the Whalen family and their retainers arranged themselves in a half-circle around us. I stood, as did the doctor. "Duke Whalen, I assume," she said, bowing carefully. "How are you?"
"Very well. I would ask you how you are, however I assume that physicians look after themselves better than anybody else. So I shall ask how you think the king is. How is he?"
The Duke seemed to be slurring his words.
"The king is generally well. His ankle still needs treatment, and he has the remains of a slight..."
"Good, good."
Whalen looked round at the doors leading into the ballroom.
"And how do you like our ball?"
"It is most impressive."
"Tell me, do they have balls in this place, Drazen, where you come from?"
"They do, sir."
"And are they as fine as this? Or are they better and more glorious, and put our sad and feeble efforts into the shade? Does Drazen entirely outdo us in every matter, as it does by your claims in medicine?"
"I think the dances we hold in Drazen are rather less splendid than this, sir."
"Are they? But how can this be? I had become quite convinced through your many comments and observations that your homeland was in advance of ours in every respect. Why, you talked of it in such glowing terms that sometimes I thought you were describing a fairy tale land."
"I think the Duke will find that Drazen is quite as real as Hospitus."
"Faith, I am almost disappointed. Well, there we are."
He turned to go, then stopped again.
"We shall see you dancing later, shan't we?"
"I imagine so, sir."
"And will you perhaps undertake to demonstrate for us a dance from Drazen and teach it to us?"
"A dance, sir?"
"Yes. I cannot imagine that Drazeners share all our dances and possess none that we would not recognize. That is not feasible, surely."
The Duke's small, slightly hunched figure turned jerkily from one side to the other, seeking endorsement.
"Oh, yes," his wife purred from behind her gold and gemstone mask. "I should think that in Drazen they have the most advanced and interesting dances." "I regret that I am no dance instructor," the doctor said. "I wish now that I had been more assiduous in learning how to comport myself at a ball. Sadly, my youth was spent in more academic circles. It is only since I have had the good fortune to arrive in Hospitus that I..."
"But no," the Duke cried. "My dear woman, you cannot be claiming that there is some aspect of civilized behavior in which you have nothing to teach us. Why, this is unheard of. Oh, my dear lady, my faith is shaken. I beg you to reconsider. Search your doctorly memories. At least attempt to drag up for us some recollection of a physician's cotillion, a surgeon's ballet, or at the very least, a nurse's hornpipe or patient's jig."
The doctor appeared unruffled. If she was sweating behind her mask, as I was behind mine, she gave no sign of it. In a calm and even voice, she said, "The Duke flatters me in his estimation of the breadth of my knowledge. I shall, of course, obey his instruction, but I..."
"I'm sure you can, I'm sure," the Duke said. "And pray, what part of Drazen was it you said that you are from?"
The doctor drew herself up a little more.
"From Pressel, on the island of Naphthelia, sir."
"Ah, yes, yes. Naphthelia. Naphthelia. Indeed. You must miss it terribly, I imagine."
"A little, sir."
having no one of your own kind to talk to in your native language, unable to catch up on the latest news, lacking compatriots to reminisce with. A sad business, being an exile.
It has its compensation, sir.
Yes, good. Very well, think on about those dances. We shall see you later, perhaps. High-kicking, whirling, and whooping, eh?
Perhaps, the doctor said.
I, for one, was glad I could not see her expression behind the mask. Of course, being a half-face mask, her lips were visible. I began to worry how much aspersion a pair of full red lips could convey. Just so, Wayland said. Until then, madam.
He nodded.
The doctor bowed subtly. Duke Wayland turned and led his party towards the ballroom. We sat down. I took off my mask and wiped my face.
I think the Duke was a little the worse for wine, mistress, I said. The mirror mask faced me. My own visage looked back, distorted and flushed. Those two red lips gave a small smile.
Her eyes remained unreadable behind the mask.
Yes. Do you think he will mind that I cannot provide him with a Drezani dance? I really am unable to recall any.
I think the Duke was being rather rude to you, mistress. The wine was doing most of the talking. He sought only to... Well, I am sure, as a gentleman, he would not seek to humiliate you, but he was perhaps having a little sport with you. The detail of the matter was not important. He will probably forget most of what has passed here.
I hope so. Do you think I am a poor dancer, Elf?
Oh, no, mistress. I have not seen you put a step wrong so far.
That is my only goal. Shall we?
A young man in a hide and gemstone mask and wearing the dress uniform of a captain in the king's own frontier guards appeared at our side. He bowed deeply. Master Elf? Madame Dr. Vosil? He asked. There was a pause. The doctor looked at me. Yes, I blurted. The king commands me to invite you to dance with the royal party during the next figure. It starts directly. Oh, shit, I heard myself say.
We are delighted to accept the king's kind invitation, the doctor said, rising smoothly and nodding to the officer. She held her arm out towards me. I took it in mine.
Please follow me, the captain said.
We found ourselves arranged in a figure of 16 with King Quience, a small, buxom young princess from one of the sequestered kingdoms in the mountains beyond the land of Tassassin, a tall brother and sister, prince and princess from Outer Trossail, Duke Quetel and his sister, Lady Gehir, the Duke and Duchess of Cates, uncle and aunt to Guard Commander Adlaine, their startlingly proportioned daughter and her fiancé, Prince Hylas of Faros, the Guard Commander Adlaine himself, and Lady Ullier, and lastly, a young lady I was introduced to and had seen about court, but whose name escaped me then and now, and her escort, the brother of Lady Ullier, the young Duke Ulrasil, we had first encountered at the king's table in the Hidden Gardens. I noticed that the youthful Duke made sure that he positioned himself in our half of the figure, so ensuring that he would have two opportunities to dance with the doctor rather than one. The introductions were made, and the dance was named by a very impressively dressed Wiester wearing a plain black mask. We took our places in two lines, male facing female. The king took a last drink from a goblet, replaced it on a tray, waved away the servant carrying it, and nodded to Wiester, who in turn nodded to the conductor of the orchestra. The music began. My heart was beating hard and fast. I was reasonably familiar with the figure we were engaged upon, but still concerned that I might make a mistake. I was just as concerned that the doctor might commit a serious misstep. I did not think she had danced so formally complicated a figure before. "You are enjoying the ball, madam?" Duke Quetel asked, as he and the doctor advanced upon each other, bowed, held hands, circled, and stepped. I was similarly engaged with the Lady Gehir, who gave every impression through her carriage and bearing that she had no interest whatsoever in conversing with the assistant to a woman who claimed the honorable but unnoble title of doctor, and so I was at least able both to dance without treading on her toes
and to attend to what passed between my mistress and the Duke.
Very much, Duke Quittle.
I was surprised when the King insisted that you be invited to join us, but then he is most merry this evening, don't you think?
He does appear to be enjoying himself.
Not too much, in your opinion?
It is not my place to judge the King in any aspect, sir, save that of his health.
Quite. I was granted the privilege of choosing the figure. Is it to your taste?
Entirely so, Duke.
It is perhaps a little complex.
Perhaps.
So much to remember that is not entirely natural. So many opportunities to make a mistake.
Dear Duke, the doctor said with some concern, I hope this is not some subtly disguised warning.
I happened to be circling my immediate partner with my hands clasped behind my back, and was facing the Duke Quettle at this point. I got the impression that he was momentarily taken aback, unsure quite what to say for the moment, before the doctor went on.
You are not preparing to step on my toes, are you?
The Duke gave a small, high laugh, and with that the timeless demands of the dance took both the doctor and myself away from the center of the figure. While our other four set took the center, we stood alongside each other, our hands clasped or on hips as appropriate, marking time with one foot, then the other.
All right so far, Elf, the doctor said.
I thought she sounded slightly breathless, and even as though she was enjoying herself.
Aye, so far, mistress. The Duke seemed...
Were you teaching Quettle extra steps there, doctor?
Adelaine asked from her other side.
I'm sure that there is nothing I could teach the Duke, Guard Commander.
I'm equally sure he feels just the same way, madam. And yet he appeared to lose his way for a moment in that last turn.
It is a complicated figure, as he himself pointed out to me.
Yet one he chose.
Indeed he did. Does Count Whalen dance it as well, do you think?
Adelaine was silent for a moment.
I fancy he might. Or at least fancy that he fancies he might.
I saw him glance at the doctor.
His half-mask allowed him to show a smile. However, I myself find it takes all my concentration just minding my own steps without attempting to scrutinize somebody else's. Ah, excuse me.
Another set. Good doctor, young Duke Ulrasil said, meeting her in the center.
His companion, the young lady whose name I forget, seemed no more inclined to talk to me than Lady Gehir.
Duke, the doctor replied,
you look most striking.
Thank you.
That mask, is it Protekian?
No, sir, it is silver.
Ah, indeed, but does it originate in Brotekin?
No, in Haspid. I had a jeweler fashion it.
Ah, it is your own design.
How fascinating. My toe, sir.
What? Oh, I'm sorry.
And your mask, Duke?
What? Some old family thing. Do you like it?
Does it please you?
There is a companion one for a lady.
I would be honored if you would accept it with my compliments. I could not possibly, sir. I'm sure your family would object. Thank you, nevertheless.
But it is nothing. That is, it is very... It is, I should say, regarded as most elegant and graceful. The one for a lady, I mean. But it is entirely mine to gift. It would be an honor.
The doctor paused, as though considering this offer. Then she said, And an even greater one for me, sir. However, I already possess the mask which you see, and have admired, and I find I can only wear one at a time.
But... However, with that, it was time for the two to separate, and the doctor returned to my side.
Are you getting all this, Elf?
She asked, as we caught our breath and executed the marking time steps.
Mistress, your partners appear to become mute in your presence, and yet you had the look of somebody concentrating on a conversation.
I did, mistress, I asked, feeling my face redden under my mask.
You did, Elf.
I beg your pardon, mistress.
Oh, it's quite all right, Elf. I don't mind. Listen away, with my blessing.
The music changed again, and it was time for the two rows of dancers to form a circle and then reconstitute themselves in an alternate order. In the circle, the doctor held my hand firmly but gently. Her hand, which I'd swear squeezed mine just before she let go,
felt warm and dry, and the skin smooth. Before too long, I was dancing in the middle of the great ballroom of our kingdom's second palace, and arguably its first in opulence, with a smiling, giggling, porcelain-skinned princess from the half-hidden kingdoms in the high, snow-besieged mountains that climb most way into the sky beyond the savage anarchy of Tassassin. Her cloud-white skin was tattooed on eyelid and temple, and pierced with jeweled studs at her nostrils and the septum between nose and upper lip. She was short but curvaceous, dressed in a highly ornamented and colorful version of the booted, straight-skirted fashion of her people. She spoke little imperial and no Hespedian, and her knowledge of the dance steps was somewhat fragmentary. Still, she contrived to be an enchanting dancing partner, and I confess that I caught little of what passed between the doctor and the king, noting only that the doctor looked very tall and graceful and correct, while the king seemed most animated and merry, even if his steps were not as fluent as they would normally have been. The doctor had strapped his ankle up especially tightly that afternoon, knowing that he would be certain to take part in the dancing. Both wore smiles beneath their half-masks. The music swelled and rolled over us, the grand people and beautiful masks and costumes surged and eddied about us, and we, resplendent in our finery, were the bright focus of it all. The doctor moved and swayed at my side, and occasionally I caught a hint of her perfume, which was one that I was never able to identify and cannot ever recall seeing her apply. It was an astonishing scent. It reminded me at once of burned leaves and sea spray, of newly turned earth and of seasonal flowers in bloom. There was, too, something tenebrous and intense and sensual about the scent, something sweet and sharp at the same time, at once lithe and full-bodied and utterly enigmatic. In later years, when the doctor was long gone from us and even her most manifest features were becoming difficult to recall with perfect clarity, I would, in diverse moments of private intimacy, catch a hint of that same odor, but the encounter would always prove fleeting. I freely confess that on such occasions the recollection of that long-ago night, the magnificent ballroom, the splendid profusion of the dancers, and the breath-arresting presence of the doctor seemed like a capstan of ache and longing attached by the ropes of memory to my heart, squeezing and tightening and compressing it until it seemed inevitable that it must be burst asunder. Engulfed in that riotous storm of the senses, by eye and ear and nose beset, I was at once terrified and exhilarated, and experienced that strange, half-elatory, half-fatalistic alloy of emotions that leads one to feel that if one died at that precise moment, suddenly and painlessly, indeed ceased to be rather than went through the process of dying at all, then it would somehow be a blessed and culminatory thing. "The king seems happy, mistress," I observed, as we stood side by side again. "Yes, but he is starting to limp," the doctor said, and sent the briefest of frowns in Duke Quetel's direction. "This was an unwise choice of dance for a man with an ankle which is still recovering." I watched the king, but of course he was not dancing at that point. However, I could not help but notice that rather than make the fill-in steps, he was standing still, weight on his good leg, clapping his hands in time instead. "How is your princess?" the doctor asked me with a smile. "Her name is Schoon, I think," I said, frowning. "Or that may be the name of her homeland. Or her father, I'm not sure." "She was introduced to me as Princess of Wadaran, I believe," the doctor told me. "I doubt that Schoon is her name. That is the name of the type of dress she is wearing, a Schoon trell. I imagine she thought you were pointing at that when asking for a name. However, given that she is a female of the Wadarani royal family, her name is probably Gull something or other." "Oh, you know of her people?" This confused me, for the sequestered or half-hidden kingdoms are some of the most remote and thoroughly landlocked places in the known world. "I have read about them," the doctor said urbanely, before being pulled into the center to dance with the tall Trossilian prince. "I was paired with his sister. a lanky, generally ungainly, and rather plain woman, she nevertheless danced well enough and seemed quite as merry as the king. She was happy to engage me in conversation, though she did seem under the impression that I was a nobleman of some distinction, an illusion which I was probably rather too slow to dispel.
"Vosil, you look wonderful," I heard the king tell the doctor. I saw her head dip a little, and she murmured something back to him which I could not hear. I experienced a pang of jealousy that turned for an instant to wild fear when I realized who it was I was feeling jealous of. Providence, our own dear king. The dance went on. We met with the Duke and Duchess of Cates, then formed a circle once more. The doctor's hand was as firm and warm and dry as before, and then took up again with our earlier eightsome. I was breathing hard by this time, and did not wonder that people the age of Duke Whalen usually sat out this sort of dance. Especially when one was masked, it was a long, hot, and tiring business. Duke Quetel danced with the doctor in frosty silence. Young Ulrusil fairly ran into the middle of our group to meet the doctor, and continued in his attempt to press some portion of his family's equity upon her, while she parried each suggestion as neatly as it was made awkwardly. Finally, and thankfully, for my feet were becoming quite sore in my new dress shoes, and I was in need of some relieving myself, we shared a set with Lady Ullier and Guard Commander Adlaine. "Tell me, Doctor," Adlaine said as they danced together, "what is a gahan?"
"I'm not sure. Do you mean a gahan?"
"Of course you pronounce it so much better than I. Yes, a gahan."
"It is the title of an officer in the Drezani civil command. In hospitus or in imperial terms, it would roughly correspond to a town master or burghead, though without the military authority and with an additional expectation that the man or woman would be capable of representing Drezan at junior consular level when abroad."
"Most illuminating.
Why do you ask, sir?"
"Oh, I read a report recently from one of our ambassadors, from Kuskari, I think, which mentioned the word as though it was some sort of rank, but without including any explanation. I intended to ask one of our diplomatic people, but it must have slipped my mind. Seeing you and thinking of Drazen obviously secured it again."
"I see," the doctor said.
There was more passed between them, but then Lady Ullier, Duke Ulrusil's sister, spoke to me.
"My brother seemed most fixed upon your lady physician," she said. Lady Ullier was a few years older than either myself or her brother, with the same narrow-pinched and sallow look as he, though her dark eyes were bright and her brown hair lustrous. Her voice was somewhat strident and abrasive, even when pitched low, however.
"Yes," I said. I could think of little else.
"Yes, I imagine he seeks a physician for our family, which is, of course, of the finest quality. Our own midwife grows old. Perhaps the lady physician will provide a suitable replacement when the king grows tired of her, should we think her suitable and sufficiently trustworthy."
"With the greatest respect, ma'am, I think that would demean her talents." The lady looked down her long nose at me.
"Do you indeed? Well, I think not. And you perjure yourself, sir, for the greatest respect you could have accorded me would have been to have said nothing to contradict what I had just said."
"I beg your pardon, ma'am. It was simply that I could not bear to see so noble and fair a lady so deceived regarding the abilities of Dr. Vosil."
"Yes, and you are?"
"Elf, my lady. It is my honor to have been the doctor's assistant throughout the time she has treated our good king."
"And your family?"
"Is no more, my lady. My parents were of the Coetic persuasion, and perished when the imperial regiment of our late king sacked the city of Durla. I was a baby in swaddling at the time. An officer took pity on me when he might as well have thrown me onto a fire and brought me back to hospitus. I was raised amongst the orphans of officers, a loyal and faithful servant of the crown." The lady looked at me with some horror. In a strangled voice she said,
"And you wish to teach me the proprieties of who should serve our family?"
She laughed in such a way that the shriek produced surely convinced most of those surrounding us that I had just stamped upon her toe,
Then, for the rest of the set, she kept her nose angled as though trying to balance a marble fruit upon its tip. The music had stopped. We all bowed to each other, and the king, hobbling a little, was surrounded by dukes and princes, all of whom seemed desperately anxious to talk to him. The little Wadaran princess, whose name I had established was Gull Applet, gave me a polite wave as a forbidding-looking chaperone appeared at her side and escorted her away. "Are you all right, Elf?" the doctor asked. "I am very well, mistress," I told her. "A little warm. Let's get something to drink and then step outside. What do you say?" "I'd say that was a very good idea, mistress, if not two." We collected two tall goblets of some form of aromatic punch, which we were assured by the servants was weak in alcohol, and then, with our masks off at last, and following a brief period to obey the call of nature, we made our way out onto the balcony which ran round the outside of the ballroom, joining a good hundred or so others taking the fragrant night air. It was a dark night and would be long. Sagan had almost joined Zamas at sundown that evening, and for a good quarter of the whole day there would be only the moons to light the sky. Foy and Iparine were our lanterns that evening. Their bluey-gray luminescence filled out along the balcony's tiles and the terraces of garden, fountain, and hedge by glowing paper lamps, cressets of oil-wood, and scented pole torches. Duke and Duchess Ormond and their party approached us on the balcony, their way lit for them by dwarves carrying short poles, on the tip of which were large spheres of clear glass containing what looked like millions of soft and tiny sparks. As these curious apparitions came closer, we saw that the globes contained hundreds and hundreds of glowflies, all milling and darting about in their strange confinement. They spread little light, but much amazement and delight. The Duke exchanged nods with the doctor, though the Duchess did not deign to acknowledge us. "Did I hear you telling the very young but very grand Lady Ulia your life history, Elf?" the doctor asked, sipping at her goblet as we strolled. "I mentioned something about my upbringing, mistress. It may have been a mistake. She cannot think better of either of us for it. From the impression, not to mention the looks I got, I do not think she could think much less of me. But I'm sorry if she finds your orphanhood in some way reprehensible." "That and the fact that my parents were coetics." "Well, one must allow for the prejudices of nobles. Your forebears professed themselves not only republican, but so God-fearing they had neither dread nor respect left for any worldly authority." "Theirs was a sadly mistaken creed, mistress, and I am not proud to be associated with it, though I honor my parents' memory, as any child must." The doctor looked at me. "You do not resent what happened to them?" "To the extent that I resent their suppression as a people who preached forgiveness rather than violence, I condemn the Empire. For the fact that I was recognized as an innocent and rescued, I thank Providence that I was discovered by a Hospedian officer who acted under the more humane orders of our good king's father. But I never knew my parents, mistress, and I have never met anybody who knew them, and their faith is meaningless to me. And the Empire, whose very existence might have fueled an urge for vengeance on my part, is gone, brought down by the fire which fell from the sky. One unchallengeably mighty force brought down by an even greater one." I looked at her then, and felt from the expression in her eyes that we were talking and not just behaving as equals. "Resentment, mistress? What is the point of feeling that?" She took my hand in hers for a moment then, and squeezed it rather as she had during the dance, and after that she put her arm through mine, an action that had fallen into disuse and even disrepute within polite society, and which occasioned not a few looks. To my own surprise, I felt honored rather than embarrassed. It was a gesture of friendliness rather than anything else, but it was a gesture of closeness and comfort, and I felt just then that I was the most favored man in all the palace, regardless of birth, title, rank, or circumstance.
"Ah! I am murdered! Murdered! Help me! Help me! Murdered!"
The voice rang out across the balcony,
Everybody stopped as though frozen into statues, then looked round at a tall door leading from one of the smaller rooms next to the ballroom. As it opened further, and a half-clothed figure fell slowly out of it into the light, gripping the pale gold curtains that fluted back inside, where thin, girlish screams began to sound. The man, dressed only in a white shirt, gradually rolled over so that his face pointed towards the moon's. The pure white shirt seemed to glow in the moonlight. High on his chest, near one shoulder, there was a bright, vividly red mark, like a freshly picked blossom. The man's collapse to the stones of the balcony was accomplished with a sort of idle grace, until his violent grip on the curtains and his weight overcame their supports and they gave way. With that, he slumped quickly to the ground, and the curtains came billowing, folding down upon him, like syrup onto the body of a struggling insect, entirely covering his round shape so that, while the screams from the room still sounded, and everybody still stood where they were, staring, it was almost as though there was no body there at all. The doctor moved first, dropping her goblet onto the balcony with a crash, and running towards the tall, slowly swinging door. It was a moment or two longer before I could break the spell that had descended upon me, but eventually I was able to follow the doctor, through a crowd of servants, most of whom suddenly and to my confusion seemed to be carrying swords, to where the doctor was already kneeling, throwing back the folds of curtain, burrowing down to where the twitching, bleeding form of Duke Wayland lay dying. 14. The Bodyguard.
Loose!
The small catapult bucked. The arm, indeed not much bigger than a man's outstretched arm, flicked forward and thudded against the hide cushion on the weapon's tall crossbeam. The stone burred away through the air, arcing over the lower terrace and down towards the garden below. The projectile hit alongside one of Diwar's cities, embedding itself in the carefully raked soil and kicking up a big puff of red-brown dust that hung for a while in the air, slowly drifting off to the one side and settling gradually back to the ground.
Oh, bad luck!
Very close.
Next time.
Very nearly, General Lattins, Diwar said. He had been sitting on the balustrade, arms crossed, one leg dangling. He jumped off onto the black and white tiles of the balcony and squatted by his own miniature catapult. He pulled quickly and powerfully on the round wheel, which ratcheted the creaking, groaning wooden arm back until it settled about three-quarters of the way towards the horizontal rear cross-member. The arm bowed fractionally with the strain of the twisted hide at its base, trying to force it forward again. End of side 5.